Good morning, everyone. Allow me to begin with a prayer to the Virgin Mary. With the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Hail Mary,
full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and in the hour of our death. Amen.
So first of all, I would like to thank the President and the team for entrusting me this beautiful task. And I have the honor to be here when Dr. Gesell called me to propose this adventure. I was hesitating because the amount of things to do in September was not little. But I considered it as a providential gift from God. I told Dr. Gesell later that in the previous days I was discussing animatedly with my brother, who is a priest too. We had a few days together in Italy, and this topic of the Pope and his language and his behavior and his theology came up, and we got not into fist fight, but it was intense conversation. So I thought it was providential for me to have this opportunity also to go deeper into what I thought I knew about him, and maybe to be again surprised by him, because that's the synthesis I can say from my own experience. This Pope is a nice, huge surprise. So, as it was said, I'm here because I'm Argentine. No, because I'm an expert on the Pope. I did try to do my homework, but mostly I'm going to share what are my intuitions and what it comes up from my own experience being born and grown up in Argentina. Right? And I can tell you right away that I didn't have any personal contact with him as he was bishop in Buenos Aires, so I cannot firsthand tell you how was it. I heard many stories. I know many people who were very close to him. But I don't have more content than the fact that the bishop who allowed me when I was very young to go to study to Rome is the same bishop who then became cardinal in Buenos Aires, Cardinal Quaracino, who went to pick Bergoglio in Cordoba, in this sort of exile, as it's called. So that's the only connection we have as far as history goes. And the other one that is really surprising to me, because even if I am a priest of the Diocese of Rome, obviously an election of a pope doesn't come around every other day. So I wasn't ever present in one election at the St. Peter's Square. But again, providentially, even if I was already living in Vienna, I was, for other reasons, in Rome in the days of the election, and providentially happened to be there that afternoon when the white smoke came out. And it was a very nice experience, but the first surprise. When I heard the name, you know that the cardinal who spoke out the name, maybe in the television was clear, but not so much. So I heard Bertone first. I said, what? So, I start asking around, what did he say, Bertone? No, Bergoglio, what? So it was one surprise after the other. The second one nicer as the first, to be sincere. So I think that from that day on, with his first gesture to ask for the blessing, he started to put some question in my mind. What is he doing? Why is he doing that? Why is he saying that? So it was not a sort of experience of someone who just continues with the usual. So it was surprising from the beginning, I think, maybe for all of us. And little by little, I started to appreciate, especially I have to say, honestly, at the beginning, I read most of what he said for the first month, then little by little, occupations and other reasons, don't allow you to read everything that the Pope says, but Especially at the beginning, it was very nice for me to hear those Argentine expressions translated into Italian, because you could tell he was thinking in Argentine and then trying to speak Italian. So he made many mistakes in Italian, but always very, very nice, so with a sweetness, or so to speak, with a plus of meaning that just few of us could get, because we could hear the Argentine from Buenos Aires, which is very special too. So it's called Porteño. So I'm not Porteño, I'm from a city close by, and but we all appreciate this kind of language. So it was very funny, very entertaining, but also another occasion for surprise and to discover this freedom that this man had. I was led for my history to speak many languages, and I see that I still hate to make mistakes. And I'm going to do many today in English, but I still hate it. And I see that he doesn't. He just don't care. So, let's begin with a famous joke. Maybe you will laugh just out of politeness, or maybe you will understand it the next day. Those are the best jokes, those that you understand the following day. But I don't know if you know what is the definition of an Argentine. Did you ever hear that? Okay, an Argentine is an Italian who speaks Spanish and believes to be British. So this joke, if you think it, don't worry, just think about it. It's very profound, because it's sort of a synthesis of the whole history of modern Argentina, so to speak, or the Argentina from the so-called independence times. So I would like to make a brief summary of this history, because obviously there is always an influence of the history, of the facts, of the political developments in a person, in every person. So I think we can safely assume that also the Pope is a son of this history, and for this reason he also carries in himself, in his experience, this history. So we all know that I think Argentina is a land of immigration, and mostly of Italian origin, as myself, as also for the Pope. He is a descendant from Italians who moved to Argentina. And so in that regard, this presence of the immigrants started to get a huge influence in the politics around the bend of the beginning of the 20th century. Okay, so Argentina until that point was more or less as every other land in South America, a land divided between the big landowners, a sort of oligarchy from Spanish descent, and then the common people who were the criollos, those who were mixed a little bit with the locals, with the Indians, and that they constitute sort of a lower class. That's a schema that is present all over South America, or Latin America, we can say. So in this history, the role of Great Britain and the U.S., the United States of America, maybe it's not so visible, but has a big, big role. Because somehow Argentina became a part of the economic commonwealth. The production of meat and other raw material was very important for the economy of the Northern Hemisphere, and mainly Great Britain, as the people who were more present there. So even if in 1807 and 08, they didn't manage to conquer the city of Buenos Aires as they tried, because the people expelled them, eventually they did come as very important partners in the economic life of the country. So this produced a very wealthy level of a class of in society that will produce this raw material, mainly meat, and as I was saying, people that may be more oppressed or those who actually did the labor. So this sort of injustice or social injustice is at the origin, if you want, of modern Argentina. Now with immigration, this will begin to change little by little. These people who arrive from Europe will all arrive mostly as farmers, but the next generation will have access to formation to universities, and it will little by little appear this middle class, the middle class. There is a book called Mi Hijo el Doctor, means My Son the Doctor, which somehow shows this reality. All the sacrifices the immigrants did in order to give education to their children, because their children will be the doctor, the one who somehow takes a position in society. So with the radical party that appeared at the beginning of the 20th century, there is the first entrance, if you want, of this political class, this middle class that begins to somehow try to break this hegemony of the so-called oligarchy and try to bring some sort of social justice. So that all this wealth that was easily, we have to say, produced, I have to stop once in a while because it comes to my mind thousands of jokes, but I don't want to exaggerate with the jokes, but there are many good ones, I can tell you in the break. But this easy production of meat, so meat produces itself, when you just let them go and gather them when it's time. That was basically the production of meat. And this created a huge wealth, but was not distributed, but not evenly distributed. So somehow it begins this desire for justice, for a social justice, and the first representative, if you want, is a man, descendant from immigrant Irigoyen, who also began from this lower class and became president at the beginning of the 20th century, and then around the time of the Great Depression. So this time of the Great Depression is very important too, because at that point the Commonwealth closed up, and they sort of stopped somehow having relationships and was more of close into the so-called political Commonwealth. And Argentina remains somehow outside of this. And it's interesting because there it begins in 1930, so the Great Depression is 1929, a series of coup d'etat. So this is sort of what is the rhythm of our modern history. So 1930, 1943, 1955, 1962, 1966, the year I was born, I don't remember that, 1967, 76, that one I remember, I was 10 years old. So this phenomenon, why did it happen? Because the oligarchy somehow wanted to regain power, political power, but they were not good at economics, and so they always could put the minister for economics and finances, someone who was from the so-called liberal side. Yeah? And so the revolution will somehow, as every revolution, betray itself. Okay? So in this process, within this process, it appears a very important figure, who is Perón. Mm-hmm. Perón is a militar, and he originally represents more of this oligarchy, but he will, little by little, because he was very astute and a very good politician, understand that his mission was to introduce now the worker class. So as Irigoyen introduced the immigrant class into the political life, Perón introduced the worker class. And especially at the beginning of his mandate, I think by the inspiration and help of his wife, the famous Evita, they actually managed to bring about many benefits for the population, the construction of hospitals, schools. So all the wealth that, again, Argentina gathered during the Second World War, and thanks also to this neutrality, was invested to create structures to benefit the population. And I think it's accepted that, especially in this period, the social teaching of the church was leading really this government. So there was a desire to bring a social justice that had nothing to do with Marxism, or so was this famous third way. Yeah? Then, as every revolution betrays itself and gets corrupted, eventually also Perón turned against the church. It's very complicated, the situation. I don't want now to, but certainly Bergoglio was a young person in those days, and certainly he experienced all this transformation and the role of the church in this time, and how the church also got very stubborn and somehow opposed eventually Perón and Peronism, and it ended up very badly, with burning church and killing some priests. But at the same time, the people, the population, eventually, even if most people were Peronists because of all these benefits they have received, somehow the Catholic population did a very impressive march, in which also my parents took part to it, which was called the March of Silence, because every political intervention was prohibited, but they just marched from the Cathedral of Buenos Aires to the Parliament in silence, and that brought about the fall of Perón, who escaped to Uruguay and eventually to Spain and remained there for several decades until 73, so from 55 to 73. So I think this tension inside of the history of Argentina, this situation has certainly an influence on what is the Pope's experience of social justice. And I think this influence cannot be defined Peronism, because anything that Peronism had as social justice came from the teaching of the Catholic Church, that already for several decades had clearly spoken about the injustices that the so-called Industrial Revolution had brought about, and how the church had to, how the society had to really look for ways to bring about this social justice. Okay, so just in brackets, we can say that exactly the experience of Peronism in Argentina created most of the antibodies against Marxism. Mm-hmm. Marxism didn't really enter into the political field in Argentina, if not as a wing of Peronism in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. But Perón, when he came back from Spain, somehow rebuked this left wing, this Marxist wing, that at that moment went underground and started with the terrorist acts that mark most of the this decade of the 70s. And then eventually we brought about another coup d'etat, the last one in 1976, that began this horrible war, the so-called Dirty War, which really was a great suffering for all of us. So I was growing up in these years until 1982, in which, thanks be to God, we lost, I would say, the famous Malvinas or Falkland War. I always say first Malvinas, obviously. And thanks to that defeat, the military somehow lost any sort of appreciation, and it was possible to start the last process of democratization that it lasts until now. So I think we have to keep in mind these influences in Bergoglio, because he is a son of this time. And again, I want to insist, because someone has named him the Peronist Pope, I find that totally superficial. And unjust, really, because again, if anything Peron had for social justice, that came from the church and not the other way around. Then, I think another important aspect is his literary influences. You know that he was a teacher of literature, and something very special happened to him. Maybe you know that Jorge Luis Borges is one of the most important Argentine authors in the 20th century, and Bergoglio, as a young teacher, invited him to come to his class, which was not in Buenos Aires. It was in Santa Fe, which is about 500, 600 kilometers away from Buenos Aires, and I think in a small school, not very important, but no one knows exactly why Borges accepted, because obviously you can imagine that he had requests from many people who wanted him to have him in his class, but the only one he accepted was this one, made from Bergoglio. He was 28, a young Jesuit, who was teaching a high school class, so it was not university, and he was greeting with these students, Borges, and also other foundational literature from Argentina, which is normally called gaucho literature. This literatura gauchesca in Spanish somehow makes present all this summary I made here from the history of Argentina. The gaucho is the person who has to toil, has to work, receives little from what he does, and lives in a huge injustice. Maybe everybody knows Martín Fierro, the story of Martín Fierro. The Pope just quoted him in the ONU. And that's a history of a gaucho who had a very beautiful life, enjoying nature, enjoying meat, horses, and being sort of, not rich, but what we can call today middle class, having a nice life. And all of a sudden, because of the government that unjustly represents the interest of just part of the society, he will be led to fight the Indians. It's very interesting how he describes all these struggles, and lose everything and become illegal, someone who is an outcast of society. And how his life goes through all these, and how he becomes a very wise person, exactly because he goes through all this suffering. So that's a foundational figure for all of us in Argentina. We all read this book, and somehow it's always present. And there you have one aspect that I think is very important, that is this speaking with images. That comes very much from this literature. Every other sentence is an image, is a metaphor. So it's very poetic, and it speaks a lot through images. So I think for us that's not a huge surprise when we listen to the Pope, because that's the sort of a way in which we all speak. We use a lot of sayings and a lot of images. So certainly this literature in general had an influence on him. But maybe, and this is something that I just heard from a friend of mine who is from Spain, he works at the Vatican, and his name is Segundo. Spanish means second. This friend of mine, his name is Segundo. We work together seminars, and we are good friends. And we were speaking one day, and he says, you know what, I think to understand the Pope Francis, we need to look at Don Segundo Sombra. Don Segundo Sombra is a very famous book. It's one of these gaucho literature. And it's a very interesting story. I invite you to read it. There is an English translation from Pittsburgh University Press from 1995. And already the name says many things. Second is not first, right? So this guy's name is Second. And Sombra means shadow. Okay? So Second Shadow. Not Second Shadow, but Second and Shadow. Because these two things don't come together because one is masculine, the other is feminine. So it's not a Second Shadow, but it's Second and Shadow. So who is this guy? He's a very mysterious person that a young boy will encounter, a boy who lives in the periphery of a small town. And he's an orphan. And he has suffered a lot. He's living in this periphery, interesting enough, of a small town in the midst of my province, the province of Buenos Aires. And he will be up for, now when he's an adolescent, he will be up for some adventure, as everybody else, especially who were orphaned, because no one could tell him to this or to that. He was very free spirit. And he was about to embark in an adventure that would probably lead him to the destruction of his life. But providentially, he meets this mysterious person, Don Segundo Sombra, who will take him into his care and accompany him in this walk, in this time of his life. So basically, it's the narration of a long trip that was very common those days to go and round cattle. And because, for those of you who know, cattle grew up by itself. They just had to go and round it up by the millions. And so the region was amazing. La Pampa is like a sea of grass. So cows grow like grass. And so the only thing the gauchos had to do was to round up this cattle and bring it from one place to the other until they get to the marketplace. So this young boy embarks into this adventure, and Don Segundo Sombra will be this person who will help him in this sort of initiation. Okay, so it's a walk of initiation. And I don't know if I had to sell out the end of the story, but even if I do read it because it's very interesting. Basically, this orphan is an illegitimate son of one of these estancieros, these landowners, who was very rich. So he was growing up in poverty, but he was the son of a very rich man. And after all this trip, Don Segundo Sombra will somehow accompany him in a very nice way. So a paternal way, so you have to read it because I cannot say everything, but basically he will help this young boy to reconcile with his history and know who he is, know himself. And he will end up being, so he will be the best friend of his half-brother, but he didn't know it. So at the end of the story, you know, it's a nice end in which this boy with his half-friend, who has a brother who is his best friend, and his father, they will live together in happiness. So somehow it's also a parable of what is a reconciliation of all these different classes and how it's possible to enter. So I think it's a very profound book. It's from Ricardo Viraldes, who wrote also other beautiful things. And I think my friend Segundo, whose name is also Segundo, was right. I think if you read that, you can understand many of the attitudes of the Pope, of that being there as a shadow, but always present, not being the first place, the second place, but in a fundamental way, educating without being imposing, allowing people to make mistakes and to gain experience for those mistakes and to learn. And allowing, so challenging, we can say, but at the same time accompanying. So I think there is a huge influence on literature to understand the Pope. Then I think he uses also literature in other occasions, if you think about the whole problem of the gender ideology. And he just answered with two words, read Benson. He said, he quoted, the Lord of the Earth is the Lord of the World. He quoted that book. Read Benson, and you will understand everything. And it's true. I then went and read it, and I recommend you to read Benson, the Lord of the World. And he, when he speaks about this colonization, cultural colonization, he just speaks about this. And in his mind is all this wisdom, not just one sentence. Okay? But he encouraged us to read it. Maybe not many people did. So I think we have to be attentive to this impulses of that come from his own knowledge of literature, and how worldly literature, if delineated, if an expression of faith, could be very helpful to look at history, to look at the ways in which God is speaking in our day and age, and try to find the answers that God is already, through these authors, proposing and giving us. So, third, I think maybe the most important, maybe not, is his theological influence. This maybe is a little bit harder to see, but let's see if what I think, also from my experience, what I think could be. As I say, I'm not expert, then I hope we have some time for questioning and debate, and we can share more. So I would say, because I do have an experience of Jesuits, I did study with them for several years, and I'm very grateful for that. And I came to know some of them, of my professors, very closely. I was sometimes had the opportunity to go for special studies in their personal rooms and to see the way in which they lived. It was very, very moving, as Father was saying today. You know, there are examples of people who really puts us in our reality help us to see how many superficial things we have. So I think, first of all, we cannot forget that, and I say this in a very positive way, that the Pope is a Jesuit. He's a Jesuit. So I don't think that he had to suffer too much to make this Franciscan bent. Sort of comes more naturally. I guess if he would have been a Benedictine, it would have been a little more difficult. But being a Jesuit, I think it came more naturally to speak about poverty, and to, because I think, at least the Jesuits I know, they do embrace austerity in a very serious way. Really they try at least to do everything for the greater glory of God. Now, among these Jesuits, maybe, and that's not a secret, I think many people thought about this, Peter Fabre could be a great influence on him. You know that one of the first things he did was to declare him a saint, Saint Peter Fabre. And I didn't know much about him. I went to look a little bit. He's one of the first companions of Saint Ignatius, and at the beginning of the formation of the Company of Jesus. And it seems that the greater characteristic of him, of Fabre, was that he sort of had a great confidence, we can say in that way, in the inspiration that God would move into the spirit, also in the sentiments of the people. He was sort of anticipating, if you want, a little flower, some trees, in this being attentive to the own spirit, to the old affection, also to our human experience, and making discernment based on this dialogue, obviously enlightened by faith, not just being, as today's society would say, led by the heart. No, whatever your heart says, you do. It's not that superficial way, but at the same time, paying attention to what God is moving in you. How do you feel when you think to do this? Are you happy about it? Are you sad? So to understand that God is moving you through these very human feelings and trying to guide you. Okay, and I think many of the things the Pope did in this almost 3 years of his pontificate, he justified like that. I felt like I had to do this. I didn't have a plan. Many people were looking for politics. Says, why are you going to Cuba? Well, you know what? I was just thinking to go to Mexico, but then I thought, I'm going to Cuba. Okay. Doesn't sound so much Pope-like. But he doesn't care. He just says it clearly, that many things he does are somehow because he feels like God is inspiring him to do this or to do that. Maybe the roots of this attitude are in this saint that seems to be very close to his heart. Then obviously he's son of the Second Vatican Council. When this council was happening, he was in his early years, we can say. I can compare more or less because he's the age of my father, so more or less I can imagine, no, what time of his life. He was, you know, a young person, and we know that he tried to do a doctorate on Romano Guardini, so certainly the theology of Guardini is very important. We can assume the Nouvelle Théologie that also inspired the Second Vatican Council. And this invitation of the Council to enter into a real dialogue with the world, I think this is something that he feels very strongly as something that is a mandate of the Church through this Council that has to continue. Not that wasn't done, but has to continue. So I don't think that he envisions this dialogue as an assimilation, but as a real dialogue, trying to discover what the culture of today is proposing, and trying to, I think as every Jesuit has done, or most Jesuits have done in history, I'm thinking about humanism, for example. Humanism appeared as a philosophy breaking with Middle Ages and putting man at the center, but then the Jesuits say, okay, we're going to be the best humanist because Jesus Christ is a real man, so let's put Jesus at the center, and it appears the Christian humanism. So I think that's the spirit that is moving him. Now, one of the starting point of my conversation with my brother was a discourse, a video message that Pope sent to the Catholic University in Buenos Aires. And there you can see him more at his ease, because you know he's speaking Spanish, he's speaking Porteño, he's speaking his own language and he can express himself. And that was somehow the alarming point for my brother. Then all the conversations about, is an alarm, is something that we should be concerned about, is he theology of liberation, and these famous questions, right? And I was saying no, he was saying yes, so back and forth. So I went, I did have just a glimpse on the discourse. I didn't really read it before. I was as a good Argentine, I was discussing without knowing. Okay, so I went back and looked at the discourse and tried to read it more seriously. And I discovered that one of the few quotes he does is from a theologian I didn't have a clue about. Maybe also you don't have. I don't know if you know a certain Michel de Certeau. Certeau is he's a Jesuit too, and I went to read a little bit about him. I didn't have time to do that. But I think this man, who was very also in search, he had different moments. He studied a lot of psychoanalysis, he studied modern philosophies, and somehow always in dialogue with faith. Okay, and letting these philosophies, these worldviews, challenge his faith, not being settled, not being, and going through a process that brought him, as it sounds, in the third period of his life, to a very profound mystical experience. So I can imagine that also this author had a great influence in his way of being open and not being afraid of being challenged, somehow of entering into this unsettlement, faith be something of a false security, in the sense that you believe to have something and you're basing your security on something that is not there, or making faith of a museum, an expression that appear often, the churches as museum, or get institutionalized, so that to seek refuge in the institution, not to go out. And also this preference for the periphery could also have relationship with this theologian Michel de Certeau. But what is the most certain, we can say, the most clear influence for him theologically, is what is called the theology of the people. Okay, and what is this theology of the people? Okay, maybe you know that. The theology of South America, Latin America, was very much marked by the theology of liberation, right? So, and this has, again, a clear root of this more or less the social situation in which the social justice was really hard to see, in which the common thing was the majority of population living in poverty and a very few having all the riches, which still remains in many countries, the fact. So from this historical sociological situation, theologians started to think and to look at the scriptures and to try to develop a theology that would somehow actualize the message of Jesus Christ for this time. Now, the huge problem of this theology of liberation was that these theologians, I would say most of them, started with the Marxist analysis. So the tool they used, as in the Theologiae Perennis, we have Aristoteles and Thomas and all this beautiful tradition, right? With metaphysics and with all the great synthesis of Thomas Aquinas. Instead, they will use Marxism to understand the message of the scriptures and of the gospel. So that was the context in Latin America. As I said, Argentina was a little bit, with this antibodies of Peronism, a little bit out of the Marxist discourse. It was not a discourse that was common among people, and also because of the coup d'etat and the military presence. Okay, I can give witness to that. It wasn't easy to think Marxist, thanks be to God, but that's a matter of fact. So Argentina remained, in this regard, a little bit outside of this theological development, but at the same time, theologians tried to elaborate an option. So something that, a theology that did not begin from, or started with, from above, but it started from the roots, from this so-called preferential option for the poor, but at the same time wasn't based on Marxism. So this is how theologians like Lucio Gera, Justino O'Farrell, began to develop this so-called theology of the people, which instead of having the Marxist analysis, they begin with the conviction that in the culture of the people, the very culture that has been already permeated by the gospel and by faith, it appears a manifestation, expression of faith that somehow add up to a theology. Okay, so we had to look at the people and to see how they celebrate, how they live their faith, and from there discover a theology that is coming from the people. So this great confidence on a people of God that lives faith comes from this vision of theology. Okay, he himself will develop this expression, the faithful people of God. Okay, with a conviction that every nation, and they can connect with a nation, not with a class. It's not a matter of the conflict between classes, but it's a nation. The Argentine nation is a people that has received faith and has incarnated this faith, has lived this faith. And in that experience of faith, God is speaking to us today. So there are two documents that I think are very important. One is 1984, about theology of liberation, in which in those days Cardinal Ratzinger speaks very clearly about the mistakes, and I think that's very good to look at. But that's not the only document. There is another one in 1986, 2 years after, in which Ratzinger develops very nicely a sort of little manual, a booklet of the theology of liberation. So what is the real liberation? And just putting right the anthropology and starting with sin and not with social injustice. And it's a very nice document because I think if you read that, because it takes seriously the challenges of the time and the preferential option for the poor is not just set aside, but is taken seriously. And but it develops it in the tradition of the church with the right tools. Okay, so I got the impression that this document from 1986 from Ratzinger is sort of the backbone of the doctrine of Bergoglio, as far as his insistence on social justice and this theology of the people, not the theology of liberation. Just that you know, because you know, sometimes I say it for myself, we just go by clichés and we say, okay, theology of liberation is, as a whole, something wrong. But actually, a theologian that has also some influence on the Pope, who is called Scannone, he tells a story that Ratzinger called himself and other representatives of the theology of liberation in Schoenstatt, in Germany, and had a meeting to see how could they foster this theology. The Vatican wasn't just against it. It was attentive to this development as a promising development for the Church. Okay, even Gutierrez, whom I think little by little went for the best, even if I still not my cup of tea, but Gutierrez somehow has a little bit abandoned this Marxist analysis, but maybe not totally. Anyhow, this theology of the people, as I want to underline, did not begin, or is not based on a Marxist analysis, but is sort of an option in order to take seriously the challenges that the theology of liberation was presented, but to present it within the tradition of the Church and with the right anthropology, which is the most important thing. Okay, this is why we hear the Pope speaking often about sin, the devil, so he has no fear to use those words. Okay, very well. So there are four principles that somehow animate this theology, that part of this theology, and I think they animate very much the message of the Pope. Very simple principle, four principles that we, if you know them, you can hear them every time that the Pope speaks, one or the other. Okay. Not all together, but so what? Which are these principles? First, priority of time over space. Mm-hmm. So people appear in time through a history, not because they conquer spaces or dominate. So this is the opposition. Mm-hmm. History or possession. And the Pope says it's more important history. Time has much more of an influence. It's not gaining territory, but it's gaining time. So I read, I hope not take too much time, but I read from Evangelii Gaudium, number 23 and 24. This principle enables us to work slowly but surely without being obsessed with immediate results. It helps us patiently to endure difficult and adverse situations or inevitable changes in our plans. It invites us to accept the tension between fullness and limitation, and to give priority to time. One of the faults which we occasionally observe in socio-political activity is that spaces and power are preferred to time and processes. Giving priority to space means madly attempting to keep everything together in the present, trying to possess all the spaces of power and of self-assertion. It is to crystallize processes and presume to hold them back. Giving priority to time means being concerned about initiating processes rather than possessing spaces. Time governs spaces, illumines them, and makes them links in a constantly expanding chain with no possibility of return. What we need then is to give priority to actions which generate new processes in society and engage other persons and groups who can develop them to the point where they bear fruit in significant historical events, without anxiety, but with clear convictions and tenacity. Sometimes I wonder if there are people in today's world who are really concerned about generating processes of people building, as opposed to obtaining immediate results which yield easy, quick, short-term political gains. but do not enhance human fullness. History will perhaps judge the latter with the criterion set forth by Romano Guardini. The only measure for properly evaluating an age is to ask to what extent it fosters the development and attainment of a full and authentically meaningful human existence in accordance with the peculiar character and the capacity of that age. So this is Evangelii Gaudium 224-223. Second criteria, priority of unity over conflict. So he says we cannot ignore conflict. Conflict is there. I quote this theologian Scannone according to my translation. Bergoglio studies Guardini's dialectic dynamism of contraries, not in Hegelian or Marxist way, in order to apply it to praxis and history, because the unity of the contraries is given fully in Christ. That is the last fundament of his much desired culture of encounter, in the non-ignorance of the reality of conflict. So he says, it's not a matter to ignore conflict. Conflict is there, but he believes that Jesus Christ is the one who brings communion. So let's allow the Pope to say it better than me. This is number 222 of the same document. In this way, it becomes possible to build communion amid disagreement. But this can only be achieved by those great persons who are willing to go beyond the surface of the conflict and to see others in their deepest dignity. This requires acknowledging a principle indispensable to the building of friendship in society, namely, the unity is greater than conflict. Solidarity, in its deepest and most challenging sense, thus becomes a way of making history in a life setting where conflicts, tensions, and opposition can achieve a diversified and life-giving unity. This is not to opt for a kind of syncretism or for the absorption of one into the other, but rather for a resolution which takes place on a higher plane and preserves what is valid and useful on both sides. This principle, drawn from the Gospel, reminds us that Christ has made all things one in himself. Heaven and earth, God and man, time and eternity, flesh and spirit, person and society. The sign of this unity and reconciliation of all things in him is peace. Christ is our peace. The Gospel message always begins with a greeting of peace, and peace at all times crowns and confirms the relations between the disciples. Peace is possible because the Lord has overcome the world and its constant conflict by making peace through the blood of his cross. But if we look more closely at this biblical text, we find that the locus of this reconciliation of differences is within ourselves, in our own lives, ever threatened as they are by fragmentation and breakdown. If hearts are shattered in thousands of pieces, it is not easy to create authentic peace in society. So, second principle. Third principle. Reality is superior to ideas. So here we can see all this criticism on ideologies. And we see how he makes gestures. Yeah, that speaks more than words. So we can see that a faith lived is much more than ideas about that faith. Okay, so let's again hear to the Pope in 232-233. Ideas, conceptual elaborations are at the service of communication, understanding and praxis. Ideas disconnected from realities give rise to ineffectual forms of idealism and nominalism capable of most of classifying and deifying, but certainly not calling to action. What calls us to action are realities illuminated by reason. Formal nominalism has to give way to harmonious objectivity. Otherwise, the truth is manipulated. Cosmetics take the place of real care for our bodies. I was watching one interview, and he was kind of complaining when he was a cardinal. And he said, do you know what is the first industry in the world? Waste of money. Pets. Yeah. Most of the Western world waste their money in pets. And second, cosmetics. So he had clear ideas from his time of being a cardinal. So he says, cosmetics take the place of real care for our bodies. We have politicians and even religious leaders who wonder why people do not understand and follow them, since their proposals are so clear and logical. Perhaps it is because they are stuck in the realm of pure ideas and end up reducing politics or faith to rhetoric. Others have left simplicity behind and have imported a rationality foreign to most people. Realities are greater than ideas. This principle has to do with incarnation of the word and its being put into practice. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is from God. The principle of reality of a word already made flesh and constantly striving to take flesh anew is essential to evangelize. It helps us to see that the church history is a history of salvation, to be mindful of those saints who inculturated the gospel in the lives of our peoples, and to reap the fruits of the church's rich bimillennial tradition, without pretending to come up with a synthesis of thought detached from this treasure, as if we wanted to reinvent the gospel. For those who are scared about novelty, it's not about that in this sense, not to reinvent the gospel. At the same time, this principle impels us to put the word into practice, to perform works of justice and charity, which make that word fruitful. Not to put the word into practice, not to make it reality, it is to build on sand, to remain in the realm of pure ideas, and to end up in a lifeless and unfruitful self-centeredness and Gnosticism. I think it couldn't be more clear, right? Fourth principle. The whole is greater than the part. So, in this regard, it's important to see globalization, localization. Let me use this because you're all wondering why did I bring this. I borrow it from the kids of my Missio Gentes. And as you can see, it was used by them. It's almost broke down, but still works for what I want to show you. So if you do this, you see this is a sphere, more or less. There's no perfect sphere in nature, so anyhow. But if you look at this, this is a sphere, right? So this sphere is defined by the fact that all points, each point, in relationship to the center, is equivalent. So there is uniformity. Okay? So when the parts are equal to the whole, okay, or the whole is equal to the parts, you have this idea of the sphere in which unity comes through uniformity. Now the Pope will speak about, let's see if I can do it, don't totally break me, polyhedric, you see, still one, but there are many sides to it. It's more messy, right? See, it's a little bit messy, but more interesting. You can watch at it more interestingly, right? Okay, let's listen now to the Pope. Maybe that will help us to understand. Number 234. An innate tension also exists between globalization and localization. We need to pay attention to the global so as to avoid narrowness and banality. Yet, we also need to look to local, which keeps our feet on the ground. Together, the two prevent us from falling into one of the two extremes, In the first, people get caught up in an abstract globalized universe, falling into step behind everyone else, admiring the glitter of other people's world, gaping and applauding at all the right times. At the other extreme, they turn into a museum of local folklore, a world apart, doomed to doing the same things over and over, and incapable of being challenged by novelty or appreciating the beauty which God bestows beyond their borders. 235. The whole is greater than the part. So that's the principle. The whole is greater than the part. But it also is greater than the sum of its parts. There is no need, then, to overly obsess with limited and particular questions. We constantly have to broaden our horizon and see the greater good which will benefit us all. But this has to be done without evasion or uprooting. We need to sink our roots deeper into the fertile soil, come from Argentina, and history of our native place, which is a gift of God. So this is the theology of the people. Okay? The people of God has these roots. We can work on a small scale in our own neighborhood, but with a larger perspective. Nor do people who wholeheartedly enter into the life of a community need to lose their individualism or hide their identity. Instead, they receive new impulse to personal growth. The global need to stifle, not the particular proof barren. Here, our model is not the sphere, which is no greater than its parts. I hope that example helped. Where everything points its equidistant from the center, and there are no differences between them. Instead, it is the polyhedron. That was kind of difficult. This is why I brought you the polyhedron, you can see. Which reflects the convergence of all its parts. Everything is convergent. Each of which preserves its distinctiveness. Pastoral and political activity alike seek to gather in this polyhedron the best of each. There is a place for the poor and their culture, their aspirations and their potential. Even people who can be considered dubious on account of their errors have something to offer which must not be overlooked. It is the convergence of peoples who, with the universal order, maintain their own individuality. It is the sum total of persons within a society which pursues the common good, which truly has a place for everyone. So these are the four principles. And just to finish up, because time is up and I don't want to be too long, I want to insist on one thing, not to be scared of this poverty, and to think again that this is a Marxist analysis or something like that. Poverty for the Pope is biblical and gospel poverty. Let's listen to 198. For the Church, the option for the poor is primarily a theological category, rather than a cultural, sociological, political, or philosophical one. God shows the poor his first mercy. The divine preference has consequences for the faith life of all Christians, since we are called to have this mind, which was in Jesus Christ. Inspired by this, the Church has made an option for the poor, which is understood as a special form of primacy in the exercise of Christian charity, to which the whole tradition of the Church bears witness. This option, as Benedict XVI has taught, is implicit in our Christian faith, in a God who became poor for us, so as to enrich us with his poverty. This is why I want a church which is poor and for the poor. They have much to teach us. Not only do they share in the sensus fidei, but in their difficulties they know the suffering of Christ. We need to let ourselves be evangelized by them. The new evangelization is an invitation to acknowledge the saving power at work in their lives and to put them at the center of the church's pilgrim way. We are called to find Christ in them, to lend our voices to their causes, but also to be their friends, to listen to them, to speak for them, and to embrace the mysterious wisdom which God wishes to share with us through them. So I think that's a clear view of what he thinks when he thinks of the poor. It's concrete people with a faith, not an ideology, not the ideology of poverty. It's concrete people with a faith. So to add, I think most of all he remained himself. My brother was telling me that he read somewhere that the Pope said, heard this voice again from the Spirit, as they were saying, Francis, remain yourself, because at 78, if you try to change, you're just going to make you ridiculous. So just stay as you are. And I think he has been faithful to that. But I have to say that for what I hear from people who work close to him, one huge change is his smile. And you can watch some videos as he was cardinal. He wasn't smiling. He had what we call in Argentina a funeral face. Not because he was sad, just because he had a funeral face. His people were happy, but they had a funeral face. And I don't want to watch anyone here. But anyhow, so funeral face. Yet he's smiling all the time. That's a huge. And he was asked by his successor, Cardinal Poli, how come you made us suffer so many years with that funeral face, and now you're smiling to all the. And he said, the Holy Spirit exists. And finally, I think to complete this deep trust, and which is theologically obviously very beautiful, trust in the people of God, in those 7,000 we can say that did not bend the knee to bow, I have to put some of my biblical knowledge too, that people of God, that God saved, and he believes that there is a people there that is waiting and to manifest himself. I think also he realizes the great challenges of secularization, and this is why he speaks so much of the new evangelization and how he announces himself the kerygma. There will be a whole other conference, I think, about his way of catechizing, putting really the kerygma, the first announcement, at the foundation of his teaching and his way of life, not only his teaching. So I want to stop here and open up the floor for questions if there are any.